So let us start now the last session of today, which is called open discussion. According to the democratic style of our behavior, open discussion means that people who want to participate in this open discussion can raise any question, but they first have to negotiate with the chairman of the session. Yes? There is a list of people who have already done so, yes, and actually the organizers specially asked several people to participate, and one of these people is Duncan Haldane, who will get the word first, please.
Okay, you can hear me, right? What? Okay. Yeah. Okay, I guess I'm the first in this general discussion session. I was going to just tell a little bit about some stuff we looked at as an analog of the BEC to BCS crossover, and it's reasonably cute. It shows the same kind of general feature that essentially there's a smooth crossover between the analog of the BEC and the analog of the BCS state. In this case, in the rotating trap, there's a long-standing interpretation of the Laughlin state as a, in some sense, as a Bose condensate state, where you view it as a condensate of a vortex plus electron composites. And so this is the composite boson picture of the quantum Hall effect, which is the kind of another version compared to the composite fermion picture of the quantum Hall effect. You can regard formally the quantum Hall systems as a kind of Bose condensate, but the Chern-Simons couplings generate a gap that make it incompressible rather than compressible, and get rid of the gapless phase-on modes in the long-range order. So in this picture, the Laughlin state of molecules, in particular the Laughlin state of nu equals two, nu equals a half state of molecules, which is the most spread out one you get when you spin a rotating trap rapidly, is the analog of the BEC state. Okay. And what's the analog of the BCS state? Well, that would be on the other side of a Feshbach transition, that would be the nu equals two state of atoms, of spin one half atoms in a rotating trap. And so we should expect, as we tune a Feshbach-type term that converts, at least a theorist Feshbach-type term that converts a pair of atoms into a doubly charged or double atomic charged molecule, will give us a crossover between a nu equals two state of spin half fermions and a nu equals a half state of double charge or double atomic number molecules. And in fact, that's what one can do. And one, in this case, sorry. Yeah, you multiply by square. So this is nu equals a, this would be a charge one thing, nu equals two. This would be a nu equals a half state of charge two objects, and you multiply by the square of the charge. So it's a half times two squared is two. Okay. So, yeah. Sorry, nu would be the filling factor, which in this case, which in the quantum Hall context is a number of electrons per vortex. Here would be the number of atoms, number of electrons per flux quanta. Here would be the number of atoms per vortex. Okay.
So, even though on the law because of the
Yeah, the Lofton state for bosons is even, an even denominator, so it's 1/2, and then the fermions would be 2. So actually that's the analog, and it's quite interesting one could, in taking that analogy and going back and seeing, well, one should be able to rewrite, as one can rewrite the Fermi C state of fermions in a way that goes over continuously to a BCS state by writing it in this kind of Pfaffian type forms. One can do the same thing, rewrite the state of the Landau level filled with up and down spin electrons, which is this form up here. This would be, well, there's various forms of it. The most familiar one is probably this form here, where you have this would be a Slater determinant or van der Mond determinant of the upspin electrons with odd coordinates, and a van der Mond determinant of the downspin electrons with the down coordinates, and you give them a spinner index U for up and V for down. And by reorganizing, this thing is, of course, has to be anti-symmetrized between all the electrons. The upspins and the downspins have to be anti-symmetrized together. So you act on such a wave function with the anti-symmetrizer. One can actually do manipulations which make these two things equivalent under the anti-symmetrizer to make it explicitly look like this would be I've paired 2i, label 2i plus 1 upspin electron with label 2i downspin electron. And one can rearrange it to get a thing which is basically the Laughlin factor between the center of mass of the two pairs, and then a spin singlet combination of the magnetic combination. So actually by taking this analog with that, you can write wave functions that go between BCS and BEC, you can actually re-manipulate the quantum Hall states to actually make mu equals 2 spin half fermions filling a Landau level completely filled with both spin components, and hence intrinsically a singlet state, like a BCS singlet state, to look like the Lofton state. This is actually at one end, and actually I suppose I should be able to write down a more general wave function where you have a bit of this and a bit of this, which in the spirit of writing the ansatz for the mixture, the state which contains a mixture of both, right? Yeah, I didn't actually do that, but requires one to just extend the Hilbert space a bit. I'm sure one can do that. In fact, you can see that this is the Zi minus Zj squared is the Lofton state, and capital Z's are just, these are the equal to the sum or the center of mass coordinate of these guys. So armed with that, one can now add that's a bit not very good. It's got rubbed off at the bottom, I see. Make a model which one can then play with. And Nigel Cooper came up with an interesting idea to study these Feshbach resonances in the lowest Landau level. He did it for bosons. And so we're going to start with the same thing. I guess there's a little detail in these Feshbach resonances that one, of course, needs to choose. In general, one can't write a delta function down there. You need something to give you some kind of ultraviolet cutoff in the problem. So you need actually to convert the fermion at X and a fermion at X prime, and you convert it to a molecule whose position is at the center of mass of the two. So the center of mass of this system, the Galilean invariance of the system, is invariant under the Feshbach term. But in general, you need to have a G of X prime which is spread out. And if you actually want to make this work completely within the lowest Landau level, there's a unique choice you have to make, which is basically the Gaussian choice. If you actually make the Gaussian lowest Landau level form factor choice, you can have this process occur completely within the lowest Landau level. Okay. So that's this choice here. If you look at the atomic wave functions in the lowest Landau level and the molecular wave functions, you can convert in between the two if you rewrite them. The electron wave function of a pair would be a product of a center of mass term and a relative momentum term, a relative coordinate term. And if the relative term is picked out is exactly matched to the cutoff you use in Feshbach, then you get these transitions which preserve the lowest Landau level index. Alternatively, you can think of of doing it for any kind of Feshbach term, but just taking a weak coupling Feshbach resonance. So then you end up with this lowest Landau level conserving term, and it's very straightforward to put this thing on a computer and do some finite size numerical diagonalizations. And the method of choice for these things is typically the sphere. It can be a sphere or a torus. And then on the spherical geometry, the position on the sphere is just pointed to by the angular momentum of the vector. Okay, and so the spin of the particles are represented by spins with a spin equal to the number of the vortices in the system, the vorticity. In the other context, it would be the magnetic flux, but here it's the number of vortices. And then the vector just points to where they are, and then you're just converting an atom, which is a half-length spin, and two of them line up in a ferromagnetic way to give you a molecule. So it's a very simple term to evaluate. So we have two atoms go to one molecule, and instead of having a nice continuous band of a spectrum of a band of atoms that starts at energy zero and goes up, we just have a single energy, the single Landau level for both the atoms and the molecules. So the two particle problem is absolutely trivial compared to the case of the usual Feshbach term without rotations. So we just have, for the two particle problem, we just have a 2x2 matrix coupling the molecule state and two atoms in the lowest Landau level, which will be in a, and the only two that mix are the ones with relative angular momentum zero, which can convert into the molecule. Okay, so let's have a look at see what happens when we 14. Okay, so one can actually just take this very simple Hamiltonian, and actually, because there's no difference between it's actually got a symmetry where the thing is completely the same as I turn it upside down. but we take the very simple, I guess because of this feature that there's only one energy. So in the usual problem, everything at positive energies is a continuum of states. Here it's all compacted into a Landau level. And one can now look at what happens as you cross the Feshbach resonance. This is, I guess, a system with, six molecules converting to 12 atoms or interconverting. And as I go through the Feshbach resonance, one can see how you go from, this is going through to all atoms on the atomic side of the Feshbach resonance, gradually building up to, at the Feshbach resonance condition itself, a mixture of atoms and molecules. They're up to six molecules in the system, so it's about halfway converted there. And if you look on the other side of things, then you start at this point and work your way down, and eventually you end up as completely molecules. Okay, so the wave functions go smoothly through, and it's useful to, if we actually look at the excitation spectrum at the Feshbach resonance itself, you'll find as you go through all the way there is a quantum Hall state which interpolates continuously between the fermion nu equals 2 state and the molecular nu equals 1/2 state. There it is at the still with a nice gap separating it from all the quasi-particles and excitations you have at nu equals 0. And okay, one can then look in the various limits of the thing. And okay, let's find the other one, start at the other end. So this is the atomic, starting in the atomic end, one sees one has a single filled Landau level state, which is the lowest state, and then the only excitations you can make are excitations to higher to the higher Landau levels, right? And as you move your way, move down through the thing, you eventually see how this this spectrum here broadens out all the time, generating some interesting features. And what else? And finally, as you go through, one sees quite a complicated structure near the Feshbach's term, and then when one goes strongly to the molecule limit, you can compare that and essentially see that it matches completely onto a Laughlin state of bosons with very little else. Okay. But by looking at the detail of the spectrum, you can see that you can't fit it in the intermediate region by just purely two-body interactions. The Feshbach resonance will generate two-body, three-body, four-body interactions between the things, and in the quite complicated spectrum you get in the middle. But everything interpolates pretty smoothly otherwise. And the other thing I guess I'll say. One interesting thing one can see if one looks at the excitation spectrum of this system is, of course, you get spin charge separation happening in the structure, because in the atomic limit, the only excitations I can make are a hole in the fluid, or if I take one out, so the hole of course has a spin 1/2, it's a missing spin 1/2 atom, and by particle hole symmetry it's a spin 1/2 object. On the other hand, in the molecular limit, the charge 1, or the atomic charge 1 object, is a semion. I take one molecule out of the system, I create two of these fractional statistics objects, which are charge 1 objects which obey half-fractional statistics, the Laughlin quasi-particles. Right? The quasi-particles, the quasi-holes of a Laughlin nucleus, a half-boson stator, carry half the quantum number of the fluid that makes it up, and since the fluid that makes it up is charge 2, is atomic number 2 molecules, they're equal to one atom. So you can clearly if you have a spare atom floating around, you can dump one of those atoms into one of the two quasi-holes, and then you find that the object you get, if you have an odd number of atoms present in the molecular fluid, is one charged spinless object and one neutral or atomically neutral spin 1/2 object. So it's quite an interesting example of the spin charge separation. Okay. So I guess as a toy model, it's kind of interesting, and it basically also confirms what seems to be coming out from all the other BEC to BCS Feshbach studies, that things seem to behave smoothly. Yeah.
So you're saying that the excitation
the
two
are different, or they? Actually, the lowest state is a bound state of that's right. To make the excitation of the Phil Landau level case, you actually have to put things in the higher. You can make a hole in one and yeah. But as you cross over, the spin can become detached from the hole in the low energy sector of the low energy states of the theory. So you have so in the Laughlin state region, you can get these spin-ons and hole-ons there.
If there's a qualitative change in the excitation, that's actually counter to the idea of a very smooth crossover with different topological structures.
Yeah. Well, these things seem to be bound together in a way, but they look like they should be able to dissociate. So in some sense, I suppose, once you've got the new equals the half molecular state, I guess you have half vortices in it, right? Yeah. Okay. I'm done.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation. Mm-hmm. Questions?
Carlos, please.
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me.
We have the stop already by Subir Sachdev about
the fact mm-hmm. that in a boson, so you take a boson, atomic boson cloud, and then you convert it to molecules of bosons.
Yeah, I feel on this side, it looks like it's unstable against separation.
Right, but if you, by fiat, declared, okay, this is not going to happen, could you still find a smooth crossover, or do you think there would be a quantum phase transition?
I'm not sure. I think if you could find a smooth crossover, you would presumably have to have between the condensates. Now, this is a rotating system, and the trouble is there weren't any kind of, yeah, with the problem of attractive interactions, it was impossible to formulate the quantum Hall version of Sachdev's thing with the to go between quantum Hall states of double charge bosons and single charge bosons. If you could get a continuous transition without a phase separation, I'm sure you would get this Ising transition. But the question is whether you can avoid that by, yeah. We tried that, but wasn't able to come up with a nice model that was stable, with a stable quantum Hall state at either end of the system.
Yeah. Okay, two questions. So the first question is, do you have some like the chiral fermion on the edge, so that could have some kind of unique feature that distinguishes the phase transition between two states? This is fractionized phase.
Yeah, I suppose actually the edges of the new equal. Well, let's see.
This is like flowing in one direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the edge of the new equals two fermion state would actually have. Would have spin a half excitations too. There would be a C equals two edge, right? And so I suppose, yeah, there would be some. The Lofton molecular state does appear only to have, would only have a one state. So you're right, there probably is a lost spin degree of freedom edge state somewhere. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So they just want to make sure I understand. So this holon and the spin can, there's no, so they can combine, right? They can separate by weight.
It's not quite clear, right? But okay. It looks like they should be deconfined. Of course, there may well be you're right. There may be a transition, a deconfinement transition that happens associated with the loss of the spin edge state. Yeah.
Do we have more questions?
Yes, quick question.
One thing I didn't understand, Duncan. Didn't understand many things, but yeah. One thing I didn't understand is like in standard treatments of not this system but of the Feshbach crossover region, all that sort of stuff, one does it theoretically in terms of some diagrammatic approximation like T matrix or mm-hmm. mean field or bells and whistles. But the thing is, now in your calculation, how does one think of it in terms of the method? Is it in some sense that it's a numerical method? Is it in some sense the exact solution?
Yeah.
Yeah,
the small
so that's
of particles,
what's interesting,
yeah.
I guess, about yeah. it, that it's not perturbative in any
no,
way.
No, you can just do it, right? So, but of course, you have to interpret small particle calculations.
Okay, do we have more questions? No, we don't. Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. We are a little bit behind the schedule, and I would like to implement the idea of Alan Griffin. The idea is the following. The first question is free. The second question of the same person costs $10. The third question, $50, and so on. Okay.
Pay to the director. Pay to the master.
Of course, you should pay to the chairman. But you are the next speaker. You are safe. You are in a safe position. The next speaker is Maxim Olshani. Please.
Thanks. Which end? The small one.
The small one you have to put in here.
In my pocket. And not forget them.
Yes, this one you put here.
Right, and that's antenna. Wow.
Just test whether people hear you.
Progress is making progress.
Do you hear him?
Do you hear me? Okay, all right. So Today I'm going to discuss, the title is Interaction-Induced Degradation of Interference Fringes in Waveguide-Based Atom Interferometries. So what it is in reality, it is, this work is devoted to, we're trying to find a quantitative answer on the question of what is the relationship between correlation functions and interferometry indeed, because it's clear that there is one, but it's not clear what the actual formulas are, whether the long-range correlations are important or short-range correlations are important, whether you have to use the static correlation function or the dynamical correlation function. And of course I was quite lucky to have my talk after Trey's presentation, because I will try to answer the question that arose after his talk, which is what do we lose interference fringes in the Tong-Girardot regime, which is supposed to be strongly correlated, and logically there shouldn't be any interference, there shouldn't be any fringes, but nevertheless, experiment shows that you do lose interference. And in my last slide, I will try to answer this question. It's not that simple as you might think. So what is the history of the subject? So the first interference experiments with Bode and Tang condensates were performed at MIT. Then we saw the presentation of Mark Kazevich. The interference experiments at NIST. So as usual, Jora explained almost everything. His basic conclusion was that if you're deep in the mean field regime, if you have condensates, you needn't worry about the degradation of fringes, and if you increase interactions, something bad should happen. And it was all the long-range theory and the long-range correlations, at least static, are known due to Duncan Haldane. So these predictions, both at finite temperature and zero temperature, were confirmed at Arcee and Hanover. And then Marvin Girardot, who is also in the audience and who is the author of this talk, addressed the question of the interferometry in the Tong-Girardot regime. And indeed, what happened is that you need to have a strong beam splitter, a beam splitter whose K vector exceeds the K Fermi, exceeds the Fermi momentum, and only then you indeed can see some fringes. But now, if you look at the list of existing experiments that were truly in the monomode regime, meaning that both temperature and the chemical potential were below, both chemical potential and temperature were below the transverse energy spacing. So in both Orsay and Hanover experiments, the temperature was still slightly higher. So what we see is that in four existing experiments, so one by Emmanuel Bloch, experiment at NIST, experiment by Tillman Esslinger, and the recent results from David Weiss from Penn State, in all four experiments, gamma is either of the order of one or even higher, as in the last case, and apparently there is something I don't clearly understand yet what's the interplay of the experiment parameters is, but it turns out that if you had enough guts to get to the true one-dimensional regime, you are already at gamma of the order of one, and there the story dramatically changes, because as I'm going to show, the long-range correlations become less and less prominent, and what plays a role is the short-range part of the correlation function. And it turns out that in a certain regime, you can get away even with the static correlation function. So what we needed is a toy model. What we needed is a toy model, and indeed we invented one. So the toy model is the following one. So you start. It's 1D. Ground state, so 1D ground state, and we apply to the ground state, we apply the phase imprinting pulse, which is just a very strong but very short in time standing wave. So during that time, atoms don't have time to redistribute their positions, but they just acquire a phase that depends on the coordinate. And people who are of my age or older know that it's called the Raman-Nutt approximation. Probably younger people don't know because they didn't do much of lazy cooling. So what you get there, so in the beginning you see nothing, and then you see a standing wave appearing. And if you didn't have any interactions, here in the dashed line I show the amplitude of the standing wave you get. So then you take into account interactions, and what turns out to be the case is that when you turn on interactions, the visibility of the fringes decreases. So this solid line shows the fringes in presence of interaction. So far, what we do so far is that we work in the regime of a strong beam splitting, where the recoil energy, which is the kinetic energy associated with the momentum of the photons in the beam splitter, is much greater than mu. What happens in this case is that, as you know, interactions could play a dual role. So first, this first role is that they spoil the initial correlation function of the gas, just the ground state correlation function, and then next they can play a role during the interferometric cycle. What turns out to be the case is that in this regime only the first thing is relevant, the second effect is much smaller. So indeed we can apply the only knowledge we need is the static correlation function. And in fact, even more than that, in this regime, what's important is the short-range part of the correlation function, and you can even derive a simple formula, which would apply formally in all dimensions. So you don't need three dimensions, and this k vector, n is the density, and c2 is the coefficient in front of the second term of the Taylor expansion of the two-point correlation function. But the nice thing about one dimensions is that the system is integrable. And you can deduce the value of this coefficient from the exact solution. Now, if you look at the actual numbers, and what I mean by actual numbers is that I take again four existing experiments which are truly in 1D, and performing a Duncan experiment of applying the phase imprinting procedure to it, and compute the degradation of the fringes, and you see that at least in two out of four cases the degradation is pretty significant. So what I am presenting is not a complete bogus. I mean, these numbers are real. So a few words about how this short-range correlation function was computed, or at least okay. A few words about our general results on the short-range expansion of the correlation function. So what we know so far is the first three, or it depends on how you count, the first four terms of the Taylor expansion of the two-point correlation function of the delta interacting Bose gas. I forgot to tell that I work with bosons and with short interacting bosons. And I have a slide that explains the mathematical techniques behind, but I'll show you. I won't show it unless you ask me. Just to again to give some touch of reality. It has singularity. It has for all odd powers.
Yes, I saw the third power.
For all odd powers, it is singular. The physics stems from the singularity in the many body wave function, because there was a zero range interacting bosons, and there was a jumping derivative in the many body wave function. So we compare these. We compare our short range correlation function with the. With ab initio diffusion Monte Carlo simulations by Giorgini and and Astrocharchik. So you can see that within, again, so within the healing length where the short range should work well, the agreement is pretty good, and this gives us a very precise test for the what for the diffusion Monte Carlo, because our results are exact. So why? No, those are no. It's an exactly solid model. There's nothing you can do.
Checks
didn't make any error. Okay. Okay, and now, okay. So and now answering this question about why, in fact, experimentally, when we reduce the density in one dimension, so we reduce the density in one dimension, we get closer and closer to the Tong-Girardot regime, which is a strongly correlated regime, and we would expect a strong suppression of interference effects. Instead, we see the opposite. And in fact, the related question is that what happens if we decrease density to zero? We should get an ideal gas where there is no any degradation. So the answer to this question, as far as I see it, is the following one. So it depends on what we mean by strong correlations. So the strength of correlations affects the long range behavior of the correlation function. So if you are in the mean field regime, if you are close to a quasi Boltzmann state, the correlation function is almost flat. So you can go large distances and still don't see any degradation. And as you increase correlations, the long range behavior of the correlation function becomes sharper and sharper. But at the same time, when you decrease the density, the border between the long range and short range shifts to the right. But the wavelengths for our beam split stays the same. So it becomes, I mean, this wavelength of our beam splitter belongs more and more to the short range region. And in the short range region, you have the opposite process. So as we decrease the density, the correlation function becomes flatter and flatter, and therefore therefore almost doesn't decay. So you have to be careful about if you have to define well what the strong correlations mean. I mean, they could have entirely opposite effects in two different parts of the correlation function, and the net result is that the degradation of interference for fringes should scale in the limit of low density, should scale quadratically with the density, thus decay. And now, if you fix the atom mass scattering lengths, if you fix the beam splitter and scan the density, what I would expect is that you will see a peak at some value that depends on the relationship between the one-dimensional scattering length and the beam split and the beam splitter momentum, and if they are of the same order, this peak will happen at gamma of the order of one. So the net conclusion is that for the generic set of experimental parameters, gamma of the order of one is the worst place to be to do atom interferometry. It should be either at low densities or at high densities, where again you get problems with remaining in the 1D regime, with all angular aberrations attached to it. So what we're going to do next is indeed to relax. Yes, I have 23 seconds and three tenths of
it. Don't worry.
Yeah. So what we're going to do next is to relax this requirement, which is a purely theoretical requirement. Well, not quite, but to relax this requirement of the beam splitter being much stronger than the interactions within the condensate, and go to the intermediate regime. And there we would need the correlation function in the full glory, including including the short range part and the long range part. So the short range part, we have some machinery of doing that based on the Hellman-Feynman theorem and also some other tricks. which I don't have time to present. The long range is known since a long time, again due to Haldane, and we interpolate using the randomization group like techniques. But what's more important is that in this regime we would probably need the dynamical correlation function, and moreover the short range part of the dynamical correlation function, which is not known from integrable systems, but we are clever people, I believe. So that's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Please, questions. Klaus.
So, as you showed, this is T equals zero COE.
Yes.
What would you expect if you include temperature? I mean, not quantitatively, but qualitatively. Would you
below the chemical potential, above the chemical potential? Below the chemical potential, Jorah described everything.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, so but...
yeah, okay, but concerning the correlation function, the detail of...
So what happens...
I mean, the sensitivity of correlation function on very small temperature, there's the behavior for high gamma, and let's say to compare it with low gamma, isn't it then that you get more and more sensitive to a tiny amount of temperature if you are in the high gamma regime?
So in the regime I have described in the main part of my talk, I don't think the temperature will affect much, because what turns out to be the case is that in this regime, in the regime of a strong beam splitting, very large beam splitting momentum, it's only the short range part which is affected, and it is not affected much by the temperature. So But for weaker beam splitters, you will get this nice Lorentzian, and the width of this Lorentzian, you know, and you just plug this Lorentzian to your, I don't know, to your Mathematica or to something, and you get the value of this Lorentzian that describes the degradation.
Yeah, Maxime, there are so many things happening here that it's hard for me to keep clear exactly. What is being varied? So could I have you draw a certain plot on the board for me? What I want to see is fix the ratio n over k, right?
Okay.
And then plot this visibility as a function of gamma.
But what do vary in gamma? You vary the scattering length.
You vary scattering length, or vary the density, but also vary k with it. Either way.
Oh, I vary density. Okay. So that's
varying the scattering length.
Yeah. So the visibility, we should have some light somewhere. Oh yeah. Okay. So for small gammas. What? No? What is that?
Just keep it going.
Keep going.
Oh, yeah. All right. Okay. Okay. So for small gammas, the visibility will grow as gamma to the power 3/2. Okay, and then this one, and that's infinity because I don't have enough space, and then it saturates at pi square or something. So that's what happens.
And does this picture look differently if...
So I fix the density,
And does this look different if n over k is bigger or smaller than 1?
If n over k is... No, it is always... It is
always qualitatively.
No, wait. N over k.
The ratio between the wavelength and the.
I know. And the interparticle distance.
No. Please.
No, smaller than 1. Yeah. I mean, I keep it smaller than 1.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to respond to a question asked a while ago about the effect of temperature, and what I know independently of any of this general theory is that we did a calculation or the TG limit, so gamma much greater than 1, a temperature-dependent calculation. And what we found is that you can get strong interference. For this was essentially exact, except from numerical errors, but the analytics was exact for what we called a X splitter interferometer. And we found that you get strong interference fringes as long as KT is not of order KF.
Yeah.
Okay, do we have more questions? We don't. Oh, we do. No volunteers. No one has the money. Yes. Okay.
Oh, yes.
What I understood, Maxim, from your talk,
oh, yes,
that the phase coherence experiments in this Tonks Girardot regime more or less depend on how you do them. For example, if I do the juggling experiment, yes, and measure just the single particle correlation function, one body density matrix, then this guy drops on a length scale of the order of the mean interparticle separation. And that's what I should reveal in the juggling experiment. But
deep in the Tonks Girardot regime, indeed, it just doing.
Yes.
But I'm at gamma of the order of 1, which is.
But then, if you measure, and that's what more or less people can sometimes associate with the absence of fringes in the interference pattern. Yes. But you say that if you do two beam splitter interferometer in a way you describe, you see fringes in this Tonks-Girardot regime. Yes. That's what I understand.
For a strong beam splitter. Yes. For the wave vector of the beam splitter much, much greater than the inverse interparticle spacing.
Okay.
Yes.
Wolfgang. Excuse me. Just a second.
If I understand you correctly, Maxim, you've calculated if you imprint a density modulation into
phase modulation.
So if you imprint a phase modulation, how much contrast you can get.
Yes.
Of course, in atom interferometry, you want to measure something, and measuring something takes some time, and actually the time over which you can maintain coherence is big. I mean, the sensitivity is proportional to that. So I'm wondering, is there more than one criterion, namely the visibility of the phase contrast? Is there maybe a second factor, which is the intrinsic coherence time? So could it be if you phase imprint something that if you have a strongly interacting system and that the visibility is washed out after a short time?
The visibility?
It seems to me that you have calculated something which is the contrast at time t equals 0.
No, not at all. No, I propagated for the recall time. I propagate the many body wave function for the recall time and I see the real occurrence. It's a phase imprinting that then becomes the density modulation. No, it's not it's not time equals 0. No, not at all. It's much more than
maybe
that.
Then let me ask you, fine, okay, I understand that now. Would you expect that there is some difference in the behavior if you would propagate it for longer?
Yes, they will decay.
Yeah, but would it just be monotonously, or could it be that what you call now a favorable case, that it would decay more strongly after the recall time?
I would expect just some power law decay. With time. From one appearance of the fringes to another, it would be just a power law with time. Nothing more than that.
Uh-huh. So, no more questions? No.
Thank you, Maxim.
Where is Jason? Is he here? Yes. No, he is not. Aside from four speakers who should talk at the open discussion, there is the fifth secret speaker, so we're a little bit behind the schedule, you know. But the next speaker is Chiara Minotti. Chiara, please. So what do I do? How do I do it? Good luck. Okay, please.
So first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me this time to tell you about some new ideas that we developed in Trento with, in collaboration with Mary Holland and Luciano Viveri. The aim of our work is to reproduce the correct dimer-dimer interaction on the BC limit of the crossover. And in order to do this, the crucial point is that we have to include some higher correlation in the theory with respect to the one which are usually considered in the BCS-BC crossover theories. What I have to say is that this is the idea of the theory that we developed. We will go on from now on to perform the numerics about this theory. So I don't have, for the moment, any numerical result about this. So, again, as almost everybody else, I will talk about the single channel and the resonance Hamiltonian, and I hope I will stay in the Santa Barbara consensus, at least 99% of what I will say. Then I will introduce the hierarchy of correlation that we have in this problem, and I will discuss the truncation that we have to perform on it. And then I will briefly say how they enter in 2 and 4 fermion scatterings and in the BC and BCS limit. So these are the 2 Hamiltonians. In the first one, we have fermions which are coupled via a two-body potential, while in the resonant model, we have fermionic field and bosonic field, and the fermions interact through the coupling with this bosonic field. These two models are equivalent as long as the scattering length, scattering amplitude can be written in this form, which means that the scattering length is the only important parameter of the problem. The bosonic field, which appears in this Hamiltonian, is a bare bosonic field, and we use it as an auxiliary field in order to make the system more treatable. And this will become clear in the following. It's important to mention that this is a bare bosonic field with this kind of energy, and is not the molecular field that we will find on the BEC side of the resonance. In particular, this energy depends on quantity that will have to be renormalized. The important thing is that crucial assumption to apply our theory, is that in the resonance model, we can apply local potential and we can renormalize them. So, in this plot, I sketch, as usual, the scattering length across the resonance, and with this yellow area, I was just to indicate the region where this formula here applies. In this region, the binding energy will be proportional to the inverse of the scattering length, while outside here, we cannot just describe it in this simple way, and we will have in general coupling with more modes. So let's say this is the range of validity of the 2 model Hamiltonians that I described above. But in general, the exact solution of this system will involve correlation with a very high number of particles. And this hierarchy of correlation, which I will show in the next slide, has to be truncated at a certain point. And depending on the level at which one decides to truncate this hierarchy, different property of the system will be described correctly. And of course, there will be approximation involved in the treatment. So I write here the hierarchy of correlation that we will have in the resonance model. So in this lighter area here, I keep only 2 particle correlations. So we have here the density, the pairing field, and the bosonic field, and through the Hamiltonian, which I wrote at the beginning, they will be coupled to two-particle correlation and higher-order correlation. In general, those quantities are factorized, like in the previous treatment by Murray and also in the treatment by Hallen, and this leads in the crossover to non-interacting bosons on the BC side. So they both found that the chemical potential on the BC side coincide with the binding energy, and so the boson-boson interaction is not accounted for in the proper way. So the natural step to improve this kind of theory is to keep four particle correlation. So here I just represent a small set of all these correlations. So we have kind of BB terms, BAA terms. So these are two bosons. This is one boson and two fermions. These are two fermions and so on. And through the Hamiltonian, they will be coupled to any kind of correlation, and in particular also to six particle correlation. And in our theory, we will treat those correlations in the same way as those were treated before. So we will factorize them and get product of two particle and four particle correlation in order to get a closed set of equation at this level. Now we have just to realize correlation of this kind, so with four fermions, will depend on three vectors. So it's in space, the three vector would be a relative coordinate of this pair, relative coordinate of this pair, and the relative coordinate for the two pairs. And this correspond to three modulus, let's say, of this vector and three angles. And it's impossible numerically to keep track of all these degrees of freedom. So the inspiration for how to reduce in an enormous way the complexity of this problem came to us through by this famous paper by Dima, Jora, and Christoph, where they calculated the Dimer-Damer scattering length, and they found the value 0.6 times the fermionic scattering length. What they did in this paper is that they factorized this four particle wave function into two pieces, one a phi of R1 times a second function, which was a function of R2 and big R. And then they could study the asymptotic limit for large R, and they could solve the problem exactly getting this value. So what we thought is that probably, so what we deduce from their result is that it's important to keep only these two quantities, and we could take in an analogous way to what they did the R1 going to zero limit. Their solution for the asymptotic value of big R, if I understood correctly, is valid for any value of R1. It's not necessarily to throw R1 to zero. But the right interaction can be extracted also in this limit. So in our language, this would imply a sum over K1. So I didn't write all the indices here because it's crazy, but it's like summing over a momentum describing two of this fermionic operator. In this way, we can reduce our correlation to quantities which depends only on two vectors, which means on three parameters, and this can be implemented numerically. It's important to say that one can get a closed set of equations for these quantities, so this kind of fields and this kind of fields summed over one momentum, only if the local potential if the potential is local. Without this assumption, one could not get this simplified set of equations, and full four fermions correlation should be kept explicitly. And this is the point at which our resonance model becomes more convenient than the single channel model. Up to now, all these ideas, including the sum over one of these momenta, could be applied exactly also in the single channel model. But the problem is that In the single channel model, as far as I know, there is no way to perform. There is renormalization required by the local potential. So in this slide, I will sketch very in a very simple way the correlation, where the correlation enter in the physics. So the two fermions scattering can be described in terms just of this quantity. In general, all the solution of the gross of the Schrödinger equation, the two body Schrödinger equation, can be written as a superposition of these two quantities. And we will get a Schrödinger equation with a two-body potential with a fermionic scattering length described by this resonance shape. An important thing that I forgot to say just at the beginning, we set for simplicity the background scattering length to zero. That's why the fermionic scattering length looks so simple. But this is, anyway, a good approximation close to the resonance. To describe four fermions scattering, we have to include this kind of correlation, and with this we can build a four fermions wave function which obeys the same Schrödinger equation that was solved in the paper I cited above. So the two-body potential appearing this Schrödinger equation will be characterized again by the same fermionic scattering length as here, while the dimer-dimer scattering length will be this number. As I said, we didn't get out this number yet because we didn't perform the numerics, but we believe this will show up, for instance, when we calculate the chemical potential also. In the BC limit, the main component will be this correlation again, because the condensate will be created into the highest line bound state of this two fermion scattering potential. Anyway, keeping into the problem higher order correlation is very important to get the right interaction between these pairs. In the BCS limit, we could write an ansatz where a superposition of this correlation can solve, let's say, the exact many-body physics. I can show you in another slide if you want what I mean with that. And it's important to point out that this correlation was not included in previous treatment of the BC-BCS crossover. So as I said, I don't have numerical result, and we cannot yet quantify which would be the quantitative effect of these extra terms in the BCS limit. But for sure, we know that the effect in the BC limit will be macroscopic and quantitative very important, because, for instance, the chemical potential will change, the size of the condensate will change, and all consequences of that, like collective excitation and vortex core, if one wants to think about it, they will be also strongly affected by the correct dimer-dimer interaction. So I have already finished. Here I want to summarize the idea. So we believe that by keeping those correlation, we will get the correct bosonic scattering length in the BEC limit. However, we point out a qualitative change of the many-body wave function also in on the other side of the resonance. What we cannot be sure about is the validity of our truncation in the unitarity limit, because probably there even higher order correlation might become important in the problem. Anyway, we plan to compare as soon as possible our numerical result with Monte Carlo results in order to see if they are correct. In order to describe this region out of the, let's say, the 1 over a square binding energy, one could include more resonances. This is in principle feasible, but in practice will be very, very heavy from the numerical point of view. Also, the inclusion of a non-uniform system is in practice feasible, but will become a six-dimensional problem, and so it's in practice not treatable. The last point I want to make is that within this model, we should also be able to study the dynamics of the system, and so probably simulate all the sweeps which are made in present experiment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
Ah, okay, sorry.
So you implied that by doing the numerical calculation, you would be able to get the molecular scattering lengths out.
Yeah, we...
How?
Yeah, for instance, if we calculate the chemical potential on the BC side, we should get the binding energy plus the interaction energy.
And
from there we could deduce the scattering length.
Okay. You have a question?
Okay. This question probably also for other theorists working on this problem. The basic question is if I look at your approach, you have two bosonic fields, B and A dagger, A dagger. One is the Cooper pair field, and the other one is the molecular field. They certainly are coupled. However, if you write in that way, you have two phases. One is for global phase of these two, and the other one is a relative phase between these two. Okay. So the first question is whether the relative phase between B field and the air dagger field, whether that one is broken spontaneously in your solution or is broken because of certain locking effect, lock the relative phase around certain direction. And the second question is the significance of this relative phase, does it represent certain class of new collective mode in this system? So these are the two questions.
I think the relative phase will be fixed by the phase of the G that you have in the Hamiltonian. So for instance, the molecular state will be a superposition of this AA plus B with a coefficient with the phase, and this will be given by the G. Or maybe it's just fixed and real. Maybe it's fixed and real. Probably the G modulo squared appears in this superposition. The mean field. The mean field energy depends on the phase. No, I don't think so. I think the molecular state has a well-defined phase. I don't think it does.
We'll come back.
Okay. I also have a question about your resonance model. You introduced this B operator, which supposedly refers to the closed channel molecule.
Yeah.
Okay, now, in order to determine the scatteredness, I think you need to at least calculate chemical potential far away from resonance to avoid all the high order terms, right?
You're talking about the bosonic?
Right, bosonic scatterness.
Yeah.
Okay, but then when you're far away from resonance, well, and now you also had a closed channel molecule here. So are you sure the scatterness you derive here will be the same as the scatterness I derive in the Petrov's paper?
Yeah, so if I plot the chemical potential here, as I did the binding energy, okay? So this is the binding energy, it's just a sketch. The chemical potential here, so I want to be in the validity of the model, of course, and I hope I can go far away enough and still in the region where this model is valid, and here I would get the interaction energy on top of the binding energy. I think there is a regime where this can be found. Maybe the resonance has to be broad enough and this kind of conditions. But at least in the regime in which Sandro showed this Monte Carlo result, there is clearly a region in which the chemical potential is the binding energy plus the, let's say, Gross-Pitayesky interaction energy for the bosons. So I think it depends on the resonance you are treating. This is not true for all resonances, but yeah.
Just a comment in that regard, that as a formal model at least, you have two parameters here you can play with. You can play with the strength of the resonance as well as the detuning.
Yeah.
And by playing with that strength of the resonance, you can always tune it so there is a regime where you can get small a and still have the validity.
Yeah, the question is how does this map on a real atom? Yeah. But in theory, but
for comparing,
in theory is always possible.
An analytic calculation.
Yeah, to compare, yeah, this is true. Yeah.
Thank you for a very interesting question and comments. Alan?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Just one comment. In the work Ohashi and I have done, which you commented on, and based on the couple fermion boson model, actually, as you point out, and as we pointed out, RAB is zero on the BEC limit. But in fact, we can actually, because of all this interest, we just recently taken out of our theory what AB is, and of course AB starts at zero in the BEC limit, but in fact steadily gets bigger as you approach the Feshbach resonance. So we can, in some sense it's sort of interesting in the sense you go through 0.6 and in fact even get bigger, but it's amusing in the Feshbach when you get around KFA, our result actually does imply an AF or an AB roughly one AF. But this, the coefficient, yeah, goes from zero up to about one at when KFA is one. But the other more general comment I was wanted to make about introducing correlation functions that this new theory involves, I think we accept in, at least in condensed matter physics, anytime you introduce a new anomalous correlation function, you're really introducing like this BAA, for instance, you're really introducing a new order parameter. And therefore new collective modes, new symmetries, new everything. So it, to the extent you're right, it's really a major change to the theory in the sense that one is now dealing with a new phase of matter in some sense.
Alan, according to your own proposal, okay, there is a count already. Sorry. Yes, of course, but you will do so.
Okay. I mean, we're not going to allow.
Me to answer anymore.
Seems to have been decided here. I wanted to make Alan's point again, because we also have a paper showing that this factor of two that's predicted for the ratio of the boson to interfermion scattering length is special to the one-channel problem. And as soon as you go to the two-channel problem, despite the Santa Barbara consensus that there shouldn't be much difference, there really is. The AB is tunable, so it can go from zero up to two or something of that order. And another question, it seems to me you're sort of establishing the next step maybe in a hierarchy of mean field theories. Do you know something about this ground state and how it compares, could you guess, to the ground state that we've been all studying?
No. So I can show you one slide, but this is a difficult question. So we made this answer, let's call it Perrin field for analogy to that. Okay, so this is a superposition of the old guy plus this new correlation function, and this is a solution of this kind of equation. Okay? So this is like the BCS equation before factorizing these terms. So I can tell that this kind of quantity satisfies this equation, but I cannot make the mapping with the wave function you're talking about. And concerning the two, AB, the AB equal to AF, yeah, I didn't mention that because I don't know if this can be reproduced, truncating this hierarchy in some intermediate way, maybe not very consistent way. But I mean, we believe that the right scattering length is 0.6, so the aim is to reproduce the right one mainly. But it would be interesting to understand where this two comes from, which is not.
Mm. Okay. Thank you for your very interesting questions. Are there more questions? No. Then you are the next speaker.
Thank you very much, Chiara. Thank you.
Excuse me. Please put this into your pocket. And this you can handle yourself.
I think it can.
Is the mic on here? Sort of. I had two reasons to want to do a little second presentation here. One of them is a set of questions that Eric Cornell raised at the consensus non-consensus level. And the second is that the New York Times has spent a lot of energy and hype on why the discovery of the fermionic superfluids might be interesting to the world at large. And for the most part, the argumentation goes along the lines of being relevant, for example, to solving famous problems in superconductivity, like high TC. So I wanted to do two things, which was to address the Eric Cornell questions again, try to come back to these, at least the second iteration, and two, to teach a bit about high TC. I'm not going to tell you about my theory so much, it's just how high TC helps to answer these questions. Am I in the wrong? Should I do this thing?
There is a laser point.
Oh, there's the laser. Okay. So how high TC helps to answer some of these questions, just as data. Okay, so it's an education in high TC, if nothing else. So Eric said, well, we don't really have answers yet. Do we need a two-fluid model, a three-fluid model, as we might imagine halfway between BCS and BEC? He asked, what is the signature of preformed pairs? And he also invited theorists to start thinking about calculating finite temperature things and entropy, if only to help with thermometry, but presumably more than that. So that was somewhat of the motivation for a very short discussion that I wanted to give here. And also to make sure that some of the points, the key points, get made several times before the end of the day. One of the most important points of all is that in the crossover state or in unitary scattering, one shouldn't be doing Fermi liquid theory. One simply should, not because temperature is high, but because we have a gap for excitations in the normal state. One shouldn't use, if you calculate Pauli blocking on the basis of Fermi liquid theory, you ought to accommodate this gap too, which only works in your favor. It actually makes pairs live longer. If one wants to use calculations that put Landau parameters in and so on, one should be aware that the normal state already has a gap, and that's really what's meant by this crossover state, and I want to make that pretty emphatically. The second point of three here is that a pseudo gap in the fermionic spectrum is the other side of a coin to preformed pairs above TC. They're the same thing. You can look at preformed pairs as sort of the bosonic picture of or counterpart of a pseudo gap in which it takes energy and a gap energy to break fermions apart. So they're the same beast looked at either from the bosonic perspective or the fermionic perspective. And experiments can go after the fermions from the point of view of excitation gaps and the bosons from a collection of different phenomena too. And also as two sides of the same coin, if you have preformed pairs above TC, presumably you have non-condensed pairs below TC. So you have a new kind of excitation of the condensate. They're all part of the same story. That means that below TC in this unitary regime with presumably chemical potential positive, you'll have fermionic excitations, you'll have pair excitations, and then you'll have condensate, a kind of three-fluid model. So the theory of superconductivity is ultimately going to be very interesting. I want to do one more overview and then show some high TC data here.
And above TC, also
and above TC no condensate. No condensate. So two fluids. So here's the cartoon, in fact, of what we would have. This would be the character of the excitation. So in the BCS regime, we'd have only fermions, and that would be Fermi. That's where Fermi liquid theory would be, and only there would it be applicable. In the BEC regime, we would have bosonic excitations. And in between, in this unitary or crossover or pseudogap story, you'll have a mix of the two, in the normal state and as similarly excitations of the condensate. Going along with these pictures are pictures that are, I hope, are now being confirmed experimentally by Cheng Chin and Rudy Grimm, except that unfortunately they don't know where TC is in these pictures. But the gap in the BCS regime should turn off at TC. That gap is again two sides of the same coin. When you have fermionic superconductors, delta is a measure of the bosonic degree of freedom. Bosonic degree of freedom only exists below TC in a BCS superconductor. In the BEC regime, again, delta is a measure of a bosonic degree of freedom, but it's temperature independent from TC on down. So it would be a constant. And then presumably in the unitary scattering or intermediate regime, it would be some temperature dependence in which it would turn on at some T, characteristically T star. So then Eric said, what are the signatures of preformed pairs? Well, I could go at it from the fermionic perspective, and then I'd be going to look for the pseudo gap. I could be looking at it from the bosonic perspective, and then I will look for pair excitations, indicators of pair excitations, new power laws in thermodynamics and transport. I can look at it above TC as bosons or fermions, really, by asking, to what degree do I have precursor or signatures of superconductivity before TC? Fluctuations are a version of this, in which the precursor effect is extremely narrow in temperature, right in the critical regime. But do I have, preformed pairs will give me precursor or fluctuation superconductivity, of which a limiting case is just the traditional fluctuations of low-dimensional superconductors. So now let me just show some data in high TC. I'm not doing theory here, but just to sort of build some intuition. So first of all, I have to tell you that high TC community is highly divided about whether BCS-BEC crossover has anything to do with what's going on. But I also have to tell you that the important question of the day, the most important question, is what causes the pseudo gap. So that's the central issue of the day. The one line of argumentation for why you might think about this crossover idea is that high TC presented itself with a very short coherence length, maybe two orders of magnitude less than traditional superconductors. We knew this in the very earliest days. And there are famous papers by T.D. Lee. I think he was probably the first, the famous T.D. Lee, to try to see how to apply these ideas to high TC superconductivity. We learned in the last 5 or 7 years that there is a normal state excitation gap, call it a pseudo gap, in these high TC superconductors. And it has the same symmetry as the order parameter, which happens to be D wave. So this gap actually evolves extremely smoothly from above TC into the superconducting gap. You almost can't see TC from the fermionic perspective. Things go so smoothly. And of course, there's all these widespread pseudogap effects. So at least this is a point of view that one could take seriously enough. And I think with cold atom studies, we will really understand more deeply its degree of applicability. So let me walk you through what Feshbach resonance analog would be. Okay. What would be the Feshbach analog for this story? What could I tune? So you've probably all seen this diagram in ad nauseum, but let me tell you just briefly. What one measures in this high TC phase diagram is temperature versus hole concentration. And we're not interested in the antiferromagnet. That's not relevant here. So the superconductivity lives on a dome. And on this edge of the dome, and it's actually the very edge of the dome, we have BCS superconductors. what really the top slide is telling us is the size of the gap at TC as a function of x. So where we lose this excitation gap at TC, where we lose the pseudo gap, point two, is where we recover BCS physics. That's really, I mean, 0.25 is the end of the dome. So it's just maybe a three quarters of the dome is not BCS, but the last quarter is. So we've got a Feshbach tuning X parameter, but as we progressively underdope, we can get more and more pseudo gap. Underdoping just raises the size of this gap at TC. And we don't, at the same time, ever make it into BEC. The chemical potential always stays positive. We know this from our angle-resolved photoemission measurements. But it looks as if we have crossover in this regime and BCS in this regime. What does the gap look like? People do the measurements if the gap is a function of temperature. And in a very in a sample, which is on the far right, which is BCS-like, the excitation gap does just what it should. It looks like an order parameter. As we get progressively more underdoped, the excitation gap turns on at higher temperatures. And finally, in a very underdoped sample, the excitation gap is almost temperature independent to room temperature. And what's phenomenal are all these different experiments. You can see susceptibility, heat capacity, our angle-resolved photoemission, yttrium NMR on an yttrium barium copper oxide, and resistivity all show a pretty good consensus on the size of the gap. This is maybe an overstatement. This is from another group, Lauren and Talon, but a pretty good consensus. It's quite impressive. And they all seem to, all cuprates more or less do this. So this gap gets bigger as you underdope. And TC goes down, and you might ask why. That's just the fact that I'm losing states as I grow this gap, and I solve for BCS theory, which would be the most naive thing, the BCS TC in the presence of a gap, TC will go down. So there seems to be a relationship between the growth of the pseudo gap and the depression of TC. So this is data, and only data. And let me show a little more, then I'll stop. People in high TC sort of emphasize that the pseudo gap is an interesting property of the normal state, but it really must have something to do with the superconductivity, and that gets back to what kind of excitations of the condensate must we have. What's a quite phenomenal set of experiments is the following, that we can measure rho s. Tony talked about the superfluid density, and I'm plotting it here by subtracting the origin for a whole bunch of different cuprates. That's all across Feshbach, where I'm in the BCS regime, to where I'm in the very, very almost unitary regime. And the superfluid density almost lives on a universal curve. That's back envelope is the highest TC value. So it's almost very BCS-like, no matter what you do, or semi-BCS-like, no matter what you do to this, to or how strongly coupling it is. But, and this is the important point, the fermionic gap is entirely different across the spectrum. So the fermionic gap does what you would expect. We can see it from the angle-resolved photoemission in a very underdoped or near B, as close as we can get to BEC system, it's constant gap. And a very overdoped, it looks like a BCS gap. So what's happening that's crucial here is that there's no sign of the fermionic gap in rho s, no clear sign. There's not a lot of correlation between delta and the superfluid density. Superfluid density vanishes at TC, and delta doesn't seem to have much to do with it. That's totally contrary to BCS intuition, where we think of delta, that the vanishing of the excitation gap is the vanishing of the superfluid density. So this is one suggestion, only one, and it's indirect, that maybe there are other, one would imagine to understand this rho s data, there are other non-condensed bosonic excitations of the condensate, because the fermions alone aren't going to be good enough. Fermions aren't changing, and you wouldn't get superfluid density going away if the fermions don't change. There's a lot of other evidence for the superfluid effect, for the pseudo gap effect appearing below TC. Again, this is meant to be intuition building. People can go inside a vortex core where the material is normal, but below TC, and the dashed line shows effectively the density of states inside the core. And you can see that there's an excitation gap below TC, and very much like the excitation gap in the superfluid between vortices. So this pseudo gap seems to persist into the underlying normal phase of the superconductor, which is the counterpart. As we say, they're sort of two sides to the same coin. And, okay, I wanted, no one's interrupting, so I'll just keep going here.
Look behind you.
He's already making faces? Okay, I'll do one more thing on entropy and then shut up.
Okay.
Entropy, since entropy comes into thermometry in this business, the behavior of the entropy is pretty well understood in these phenomenological, experimentally in these materials. What happens, just to show how different a pseudogap, the entropy is in a BCS superconductor from the pseudogap superconductor. In a BCS superconductor, the entropy extrapolates nicely to a straight line, and you can take a meaningful extrapolation even below TC, it's the Fermi liquid, and determine, people do, the condensation energy. In a pseudogap superconductor, you could imagine it has overall roughly the same shape, but this is kind of T star now. So at very high temperatures, it pulls away from the straight line, and by the time you get to 3 TC, it's extrapolating to another straight line, which is going to go negative. This was noted by Talon and Lorem. It would go negative if you could do a Fermi liquid extrapolation. And Talon and Lorem and other experimentalists have argued that that proves that somehow the pseudogap physics maintains itself below TC, so that the entropy has to be corrected for is highly non-Fermi liquid-like inside the superconducting phase, and it's highly non-Fermi liquid-like in the normal regime as well. Okay, so those are the central points. Let me just say one more time, just to take away. Non-Fermi liquid normal state, not going to escape that. A pseudogap is just the other side of the coin, preformed pairs, and preformed pairs and non-condensed pairs are all the same side of, different sides of temperature. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions?
Could I just ask whether there isn't perhaps one distinction between what happens in a neutral fermionic gas and what happens in high TC? In high TC, the holes are not sort of appearing in a vacuum. They're also the spin degrees of freedom which are left behind in the rest of the lattice, which is a feature which doesn't occur in the gaseous case.
The holes are not pair. I mean, you're talking about spin charge separation, or you?
Well, I'm just saying that the spin degrees of freedom and roughly 85% of the unit cells are still there, and you have to worry about what happens to them. Whereas in the gaseous atoms, there's no analogous degrees of freedom.
These are both singlet, D wave singlet, or S wave, or.
Well, I'm not saying what happens. I'm just saying they're there, and you have to worry about what they're doing. I mean, they may be inert and tied up in singlets, but there isn't an issue like that in the gaseous case.
It's probably more important is the charge versus not charge, in the sense that there's
long-range stuff and short-range stuff as well, but I just think the gaseous people should realize that there are other degrees of freedom around in the high TC case, which may be inert, but at least they're there when one has to argue they're inert.
Yes, just a second, please. You know, being a chairman of the open discussion, it's a small mountain hike.
some of the data that you showed on specific heat and the core of vortices is also consistent with other models of the pseudogap, such as d-density wave, in which the pseudogap would be due to another condensed order that's distinct from superconductivity. I was wondering what you think of. What's your opinion of the d-density wave scenario?
That gets into a whole long discussion that this audience may not be particularly interested in, but we've certainly looked at competitive theories. I mean, there's every strong indication, because this pairing goes so smoothly from above TC to the superconducting phase, that the pseudogap is related to the superconductivity, and I think there's probably some majority of high TC people would agree. The notion that there's a gap at TC in the community at large, some components of that community view that gap as having nothing to do with superconductivity, and that's a possible theory among many.
Actually, I think the universality of the superfluid density is not consistent with d-density.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes, just a moment.
You mentioned this three Fourier model. You have in the crossover regime, say when temperature is above TC and below T star. Okay, then should we expect we should have the condensation of pairs and preformed pairs, and also possibly also some unpaired atoms. So these three components should exist at the same time,
in below TC. There's no condensate.
Oh, right, right, okay, okay, mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah.
Just on a point of clarification, when you say that below TC one has to use a three-fluid model, you mean that in an informal sense, presumably, not in the technical sense that you would need three independent velocities to describe the system in thermal equilibrium?
I think to actually implement it is another story. But there are both you have to think intuitively of fermions with an excitation gap, which will be contributing to thermodynamics, bosons with some power laws, which will be contributing to thermodynamics. And
okay, but as regards the formal superfluid hydrodynamics, the Landau two-fluid model should be still okay.
May well be.
Alan.
How would you, yeah.
Alan, you should ask the permission of a chairman. Yes? Yes.
He bowed down here.
Okay, do we have more questions? Oh, excuse me. Please.
Kathy, could you put the figure that had the rho S on it, the curve of rho S on
sure.
it?
Sure.
I can see that rho S looks like it has power law. What I'm curious mm-hmm. about is, does delta look, the way you've sketched delta, it goes exponentially to a constant at low temperature. Is that really what's happening?
This delta is a pretty good, I mean, this delta here, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
It's pretty good BCS fit in these overdoped or optimal samples.
Even with the D-wave symmetry and all
that? Oh, this is the amplitude of the D-wave gap. Which has a K structure to it.
But I would have thought it would have some power law dependence at low temperature because of the node.
Yeah, no, it has a linear temperature dependence. So I suppose if you look in here, because it's D wave.
I mean, the drawing makes it look like just like a BCS.
It is close. The I guess maybe I'm drawing all these curves all at once. The D wave, there's a constant temperature dependence to the most underdoped sample, and there's got to be a linear temperature dependence to the more overdoped. And indeed, the data is real. This is just a cartoonized version to show all the different, to show the independence of this panel and this panel, really.
So I have a comment and a question. Those are the same thing, right? They're free, a comment. I mean, the comment is that I think everyone in the ultra-low temperature gas community would be thrilled to have our work somehow contribute to high TC superconductivity. And for this reason, we're not even the slightest bit interested in hearing about how, from all the people who really know about it, how high temperature superconductivity is so much more complicated. So sit on your hands, we don't want to hear it. That's the comment. The question really goes back, is perhaps as much for Tony as for Kathy, which really has to do, I mean, I actually meant this three-fluid model somewhat literally, in that, I mean, historically, as I understand it, the existence of second sound, of a second branch in sound, was really a great triumph for this idea that there's these two separate fluids hiding inside superfluid mm-hmm. liquid helium. I don't see why. It seems to me like these really represent a possible separate hydrodynamic degree of freedom, why we can't have three fluids and more complicated branches in sound, which might be seen experimentally. And wouldn't that be great? Maybe that's my question. Wouldn't that be great?
Yes, yes, yes.
Is that our situation, which means that the two non-condensate fluids get into internal equilibrium long before they get into equilibrium with one another. Under those circumstances, I would think that a genuine three-fluid model might have some validity. But it seemed to me, I would have thought it's a priori, it's slightly unlikely that that's the case. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think it would be something one had to calculate.
There's certainly a three-component model in the sense that you could look at transport and so on as the fermionic piece with a gap, the bosonic piece with power laws. And
yes.
But more or less, I agree with the summary of Kathy. But anyway, I just want to point out about the three components. I don't like using the word fluid because mm-hmm. I feel that requires local equilibrium and all that sort of stuff. But certainly one has three components, even in the molecular BEC region, say, studied by various people in the last 6 months. Namely, in the BEC region, you've got fermions, quasi-particles, one component. You've got molecules which are not in the condensate, two components, and you've got molecules in the condensate, three components. So the dynamics of that system, I've been making this point a lot, that the molecular BEC is a very rich scheme, and I'm really worried that experimentalists trying to go to the next field are ignoring the garden near their home. Namely, the molecular BEC has all the, in my opinion, good physics already there and is not being probed as much as it should be, but there's already a three-component system.
What is important, Alan, just because it's sort of a theme of a sermon of this talk, is that not only do you have non-condensed bosons, but you have non-condensed fermion pairs, and they have to be highly admixed.
The word fluid, though, has huge
implications. Yeah, I realize that.
Yeah, I'm trying to restrain myself, but I'm afraid I might have to pay Jorah. I'd agree completely with Tony. I mean, haven't done hydrodynamics theory as my thesis. I mean, the assumption, if you have of the two fluid hydrodynamics, you have local equilibrium, and then if you have three kinds of stuff, then the question is whether the so-called bosons is in local equilibrium with the fermions. And now, I think for the current kind of I mean, if they are, then basically you get back to the land of the two fluid hydrodynamics. Now, in the current kind of superfluid that we have, I mean, we understand, we agree. I mean, I don't know whether everyone agrees, but because yesterday that we are dealing with a Y resonance, and then in this case there's very little molecular component around the resonance regime, and then so unless we have to go to the narrow resonance, which we hope very much someday we'll get to, and Randy is sitting next to us, and so he hoped that he'll produce it sometime. I mean, we first had to get into those, we first had to understand what superfluid we're talking about, and then whether in that superfluid one have a mechanical and thermal equilibrium, and then only after you decide on those questions, then you can begin to address whether there's any chance, a faint hope that you have the three.
The three applies to narrow or wide resonances, no question about it. Same thing, same physics. You have to have preformed pairs, you have to have fermionic excitations and the number three, whether it's components or fluids, is for both narrow and wide resonances.
Okay, please.
I have a comment about the three components again. My feeling, I'm not sure, but if we are in the superfluid phase, and they want to define a superfluid density, superfluid mm-hmm. component of the
right.
of the system, this will not coincide neither with the bosons, nor with the condensed bosons, nor with the fermions, but will be more complicated, which does not involve directly the single components. Similarly to what happens with the Bose-Einstein condensation, well, you cannot identify the Bose condensation with superfluidity. Here, I think that you can't identify the superfluidity, superfluid density with one of the three components.
I think you're right. And we've done these calculations of rho s that look similar to this, and it is a very subtle thing. And in fact, the superfluidity comes only from the condensate piece. That is, had you done a bad job on your approximations, you would have gotten a Meissner effect above TC, and it's very important that it is just the condensate ultimately, and lots of word identities and cancellations have to occur to make sure that only the true superfluid piece, the condensate, is in here.
Okay, do we have more questions? No. Thank you very much. Okay. In the beginning of the session, I mentioned that we have five speakers. Actually, this was not exactly true. The fifth speaker is supposed to be Alan Griffin. We usually exchange compliments with Alan when we meet each other. And Alan told me that I should get prize for smoking, yes? And then how I responded? I said that he is the best after-dinner speaker whom I ever met in my life. So what we are expecting today is the after-dinner speech of Alan Griffin at dinner. Yes? But Alan also wants to say something now. No? I offended you, Alan.
No, but I don't say it now. I'll say it
now. Ah, at there. Okay, not now. Okay. Okay, so then the session is finished. Thank you.